Cool. Yeah, well, I'm Alexis from the Perth branch of SA, and I'm a historian as well. Cool. So, between 1943 and 1945, a mass political and military movement led by the working class and headed by communists freed Italy from fascism. It was workers who went on strike in Nazi-occupied cities, risking death or deportation to Germany. It was workers who took to the mountains to become partisans or guerrillas in their tens of thousands. And it was workers who marked the final day of liberation, April 25, 1945, with insurrections in the three cities in the north which make up Italy's industrial triangle, Turin, Genoa and Milan. It was workers motivated by the desire for a better world, a socialist world, who fought Italian fascists and German Nazis to the death and won. And German field marshals surrendered not to Allied troops, but to communist industrial workers. One of the enduring myths about World War II is that only the Allies liberated occupied Europe. Yet in city after city in Italy, ordinary people liberated themselves from the fascists before Allied forces even arrived. The former partisan and historian Claudio Pavone argues that there were three wars being fought simultaneously during this period of the Italian resistance. And I think it's a useful way of framing a discussion of the Italian resistance. So firstly, there was a class war of workers against bosses. Secondly, a civil war of Italian fascists versus anti-fascists. And thirdly, a war of national liberation against occupation. So I'm just going to leave that there, and I'll come back to it at the end. But I think it's worth sort of keeping in mind those three kind of simultaneous wars. Okay, so just a bit of the narrative to start. In July 1943, the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini was deposed in a palace coup and replaced by the army general Pietro Badoglio. The army and the ruling class had decided that ditching fascism would best serve their interests, but they wanted to keep the state and capitalist society intact as best as they could. And it was a rocky ride, to say the least. Mussolini had served the capitalist class faithfully for 20 years, beating the working class to a pulp. Unions were smashed and workers' wages cut massively. And business repaid the favour by funding 74% of the fascist party's funding. Giovanni Agnelli, the founder of the car maker Fiat, he was a fascist, as was Vittorio Valletta, the managing director. And so by contrast, workers bore the brunt of Italian fascist repression. 85% of convictions for political crimes were of workers. But at this point, by 1943, Mussolini was useless to the capitalists. There had been disastrous military defeats in North Africa the previous year in 42, but I think it was the strikes of March 1943 that really sealed his downfall. So from the 5th of March 1943, over 200,000 workers in Turin struck, which was the first and largest strike wave in occupied Europe. Tiny rations had brought extreme hunger. The Allies had heavily bombed Turin in late 1943 and even partially destroying the Fiat Mirafiori factory. And so people had had enough. There was an opening for bold confrontation with the regime, an action such as a strike. And the role of the underground Italian Communist Party was crucial. They put out the leaflets and newspapers, distributed them, agitated and organised the strikes. All of this was illegal. It's a huge achievement that you can't overstate to, organise 200,000 people to strike during a fascist dictatorship. And it really meant that the fascists were no longer in total control and neither were the factory owners. So it sort of pierces that notion of total control of dictatorship. And Mussolini recognised the significance of this strike, saying, quote, "The episode has thrown us back 20 years. The same month of March, the exiled leaderships of the left-wing parties met in France and decided to launch, resolved to launch a mass struggle. Okay, so then on the 9th of July 1943, the Allies invaded Italy from the south, starting in Sicily. On July 25th was when Mussolini was overthrown in the palace coup. And so this was the start of the what became known as the 45 days. So the period of the fall of the fascist state, but before the German occupation and the civil war. So this talk's going to focus on that period of the German occupation. The Badoglio government was led by a fascist-serving marshal. And this 45 days were this, quite wild period where everything was in flux. So it wasn't clear who the government was, it wasn't clear whether fascism had been overthrown, which side Italy was on in the war, and so on. The king, who had, if people know, appointed Mussolini back in 22, the king and Badoglio simply fled Rome and went further south, which was under the control of the Allies. They ran away, incredibly leaving 3 million servicemen with no clear instructions. On the 8th of September, Italy announced an armistice with the Allies and Germany invaded Italy from the north. And on the 9th of September, the Comitato di Liberazione Nazionale, the CLN, or National Liberation Committee, was formed. And on the 12th of September, then the German paratroopers freed Mussolini from the custody of the government, and he then establishes a puppet republic in the north, the Italian Social Republic, or Salò Republic. On the 27th of September, Naples was liberated by ordinary people without assistance from the Allies, which was the first civilian uprising against Nazi occupation in Europe. Okay, so from this time, from September 1943 until April 1945, the country was split in two. The front line started at around Naples and then moved north. If people sort of know Italy, moved north really slowly. In the south, the Allies ran the show in concert with Badoglio and the king, a non-fascist regime, but by no means a liberatory one. So just as an example, they'd effectively installed the mafia into power in Sicily, censored the left-wing press, for a year, and even shot dead a few dozen demonstrating workers and peasants. In the north was a brutal German occupation backed by Italian fascists and Mussolini's puppet regime. Okay, but then behind the enemy lines in the north, the Italian resistance fought the fascists. And that's what the rest of the talk is going to focus on. The resistance was at once political, industrial, and military. Okay, so to start with the cities, resistance in the cities was led by workers and left-wing activists, and it fed into the resistance of the partisans in the mountains. There was a real linking of the military, political, and industrial aspects. In March 1944, 1.2 million workers struck. The New York Times even wrote, quote, "In terms of mass demonstrations, in occupied Europe, nothing can come close to the revolt of the Italian workers." That was again in Turin. The workers carried out a massive amount of sabotage, strikes, and go-slows in war production. The industrialists, on the other hand, thought only of their profits and so hedged their bets. They would produce tanks for the Nazis while agreeing with the Allies about acceptable production levels. And then in turn, the Allies would make sure that their factories weren't bombed to smithereens. Factory managers would give out lists of names of left-wing activists to the Nazis for deportation. At the same time, they would give money to the anti-fascist CLN, the National Liberation Committee. The Communist Party had many cells in factories in the northern cities. Some of them had access to arms and would carry out armed actions at night and weekends and then go back to work during the week. So, for example, the Redaelli factory in Milan had 1,300 workers, and a report of the Communist Party said that in February 1944 they had 20 male party members, one female, and many sympathisers. A committee of agitation exists, football team discreetly equipped. Now, football team was a euphemism for armed workers. Another important role was that of staffette, which roughly translates as couriers, but it was a much more political role than this. So staffette would transport information, medicine, money, ammunition, bombs. And it was extremely dangerous, you know, as you can imagine. So if you were caught, you would face being tortured, imprisoned, killed or deported. A lot of women were staffette. Sexist social mores meant that women would be less suspected of being involved in the resistance than men. And I've read accounts of apparently fascists would quite openly have sensitive political conversations while left-wing women were around, you know, just presumably thinking that they weren't listening or wouldn't understand. One staffetta was Rosanna Rosanda, who went on to become a founder of the far-left political party and newspaper Il Manifesto. During the resistance in 1943, Rosanda was a well-to-do 19-year-old university student whose trips to different cities to carry information and material for the resistance was done under the cover of study commitments. There were strong links between the resistance in the cities and the countryside. Some partisans were operating in country areas quite close to the cities. Residents of the cities could spontaneously join the fighting as it happened. So Florence was one example of this. So that's partisans during the liberation of Florence. Florence was liberated during a three-week-long insurrection of ordinary people in July-August 1944, and again was freed before the Allies arrived. And disgracefully, during the Battle for Florence, the Allies actually demanded that the partisans disarm, but the partisans refused and made it known that if the Allies tried to disarm them, then the Allies would be treated as the enemy. And so the Allies relented and let the partisans liberate their own city. While the fighting was still going on in Florence, left-wing newspapers began to be sold openly. Socialist leader Sandro Pertini remembers selling the party paper Avanti. Quote, "A man stopped me in Piazza San Marco. He must have been 70 to 75. Without saying a word, he held out his hand to take the paper and held it just as a Christian might hold a sacred object. And he kissed it. He kissed Avanti and he started crying." Another facet of the resistance in the cities was urban terrorism. So the PCI, the Communist Party, organised the Gruppi d'Azione Patriottica, the Patriotic Action Group, or GAP by the Italian initials, and so the members were known as GAPisti. And so these terrorists would have to break ties with their friends and family and live underground, alone usually, in constantly changing safe houses. So they would kill some Nazis or fascists before hopefully getting back to anonymity. So the Nazis were operating in the northern cities very much on enemy territory. Every Italian, young or old, woman or man, was potentially part of the resistance. And the Nazis and fascists knew that their attacks against ordinary people would be followed by retaliation by GAP squads. One GAPista was Giovanni Pesce. A veteran of the international brigades of the Spanish Civil War, which was fairly common for Italian partisans. So Pesce had fought in the Spanish Civil War, aged 18, and was a former anti-fascist prisoner. So in this role as a GAPista, as a sort of urban terrorist, Pesce killed heaps of fascists and was utterly heroic. So in one example, he killed the boss and two managers of a factory who had collaborated with the Nazis and got 150 of that factory's workers deported to Germany, where 70 actually died in concentration camps. So Pesce said, after this action, the factory went from never going on strike to becoming strike happy. Armed fighters would also organise flying rallies where an activist would make a quick two-minute speech to a crowd defended at gunpoint before getting away. Now, there were negatives and positives to the urban terrorism. Sometimes there were huge reprisals. So, for instance, on the 23rd of March 1944, partisans attacked 156 fully armed German soldiers in broad daylight in Rome, you know, which was a huge success militarily and, you know, a really bold action. But the Nazis were just apoplectic about it and in retaliation killed 335 prisoners, a ratio of 10 to 1. In what became known as the Fosse Ardeatine massacre. And the Roman resistance never properly recovered from this blow. And so the utility of these military attacks on fascist targets in the cities was debated among the left. And, you know, there could be a tension between, you know, the small military actions and mass involvement. But nonetheless, I think we can say it was a very different beast from the 1970s left terrorism of groups like the Weather Underground in the USA or the Red Brigades in Italy. And the Red Brigades in Italy did use partisan iconography. But in those cases in the 70s, it was clearly used in opposition to a mass movement, where here this urban terrorism was designed to be a part of the mass movement. And so, you know, the utility of it, though, I think is debatable and not clear-cut. Okay, but it was the resistance of hundreds of thousands of armed partisans in the mountains that, you know, provide some of the iconic images of the Italian resistance, although I don't have any images. Anyway, partisans are usually operated in small military units of 40 to 50 people, so they could be highly mobile and avoid detection by the enemy. The partisans got a lot of support from peasants. Some even joined them. And this support was crucial because the partisan units were relying on the peasants not to betray them to the German army. And they also needed peasants in towns or villages to sell or donate food and supplies to the partisans. Large partisan units actually produced a type of currency, a promissory note that could be given to peasants in exchange for food. That's a example of a promissory note issued by the National Liberation Committee. And so the note, it reads at the bottom, it says that accepting this note means that you have faith in Italy independent of Germans and free from fascism. And incredibly, after Italy was freed from fascism, repayment for these notes actually did occur. So the PCI organised the Garibaldi Brigades, which made up at least 50% of the partisans and up to 70% at the start of the resistance period. Luigi Longo, who later became the leader of the PCI in the cities, was their overall commander. And the PCI was very serious in its approach to the resistance, ordering that each party branch send 25% of its members to join the military units. And so these units in the mountains didn't have the hierarchies of a regular capitalist army. Each brigade had a military commander and a political commander. Both were elected and recallable. The political commander organised the political hour each day, where the partisans discussed the war, but also more general political education, discussion and debate. And apparently there were even attempts to keep libraries of books. Would have been extremely difficult. The partisans had little equipment. Their members often had very little military experience, were badly fed, clothed and housed, and were up against the Nazis, the most formidable fighting machine in the world. But it wasn't military considerations that made them win. It was political ones. You know, people were fighting not just for the defeat of fascism, but for a better world. Important questions of strategy and principle arose that impacted not only the war, but also the future of the working class in Italy. So should the working class ally itself with the capitalist class or so-called progressive sections of it? What attitude should be taken to the monarchy and ex-fascist Badoglio's state in the south? What sort of relationship should be pursued with the allies? And what was revolution, was workers' revolution the end goal? So, you know, these are some of the questions that came up. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about the PCI, the Italian Communist Party, for a bit now. If the membership of the PCI were fighting for communism, sort of broadly defined, the leadership of the party pursued a conservative line on all of the questions that I just brought up. It should be said, though, the party was far from monolithic. The leadership had been exiled for decades, since the mid-20s, and so couldn't just expect its members to blindly accept its line. To give a sense of the size of the party, so during the 45 days in August 1943, there were 3,000 communist prisoners released from jail. And the party had about 6,000 members nationally at this time. New working class members then flooded into the party, and it grew to around 90,000 members by February 1945. And after the liberation, in April 1945, there was an even bigger explosion, really, in membership. So the Italian Communist Party had over 2 million members by 1946, was one of the largest communist parties in the world. The PCI had nationalist politics, and its anti-fascist strategy was stagist. So national liberation first, progressive democracy second. So it was really an application of the Stalinized Comintern's popular front for Italian purposes. So the idea being that the working class would form a class alliance with the so-called progressive sections of the bourgeoisie, and the Communist Party would form a political alliance, both during and after the war, with parties like the centre-right Christian Democratic Party. And it should be said that the progressive democracy never came, even though the progressive democracy itself wasn't even socialism. During the 45 days in 1943, PCI leaders agreed that the party would work with the Italian army and the king to oust Mussolini, and would even participate in a future constitutional monarchy. And this was while the Badoglio government was shooting down striking workers. In April 1944, after a meeting with Stalin, PCI leader Palmiro Togliatti went a step further and issued the Svolta di Salerno, the Salerno Turn. So the PCI would join the king's government under Badoglio. And I think this turn actually ensured the continuity of the Italian state and lay the basis for the lack of purging of the fascists after the war. As Giorgi Bocca argues, quote, whoever collaborates with Pietro Badoglio, Marshal of the Empire, and with the king who legalised the march on Rome, can obviously no longer demand the purging of those who worked on behalf of the fascist state. And so Togliatti and the PCI received great political prestige because they provided a lot, a previously non-existent certificate of anti-fascist credibility. That's the end of the quote. Okay, so while dominant in the movement, the PCI wasn't the only political party. The next political force on the left in terms of numerical strength was the Action Party, and they had around 20% of partisans nationally. One wing of the party was reformist, the other revolutionary. And the revolutionary wing rejected both pre-fascist liberalism and also rejected the Soviet Union as a socialist model. And the Action Party attracted many radicals to its ranks. And it was less willing than the PCI to compromise on issues of principle. But the party didn't have a stable working class base and only lasted 6 years, was founded in 1942 and dissolved in 1948. And finally, of the left forces operating nationally was the Italian Socialist Party, the PSI. They'd been completely smashed by the fascists and hadn't maintained an underground organisation in the way that the PCI had. So the PCI maintaining something of an underground organisation was really important for them later. The Socialist Party also had a revolutionary and a reformist wing, and the revolutionary wing was more critical, well, highly critical, really, of the Badoglio government. And I think in general had better politics and strategy than the PCI, but were too small to make a decisive influence. There's been some exciting research into other political forces to the left of the PCI, which operated in different cities. So just as one example, historian and translator David Broder has researched the communist movement of Italy, which was in Rome, which was known after its newspaper, Bandiera Rossa, or Red Flag. That's one of the covers. With Bandiera Rossa, they were sort of dissident communists who hadn't... So during the decades of Mussolini's rule, when the communist cadres were in exile in France or the Soviet Union, the local party activists were just basically left up to their own devices. And so, it's quite interesting. While a lot of the... While Bandiera Rossa saw itself as Stalinist, it actually hadn't undergone the same kind of Stalinization process as parties that weren't under fascist dictatorship. And so Bandiera Rossa was actually the biggest resistance faction in Rome and had a political line to the left of the PCI. So Broder argues that they rejected the idea of a common national interest and, quote, pursued a class war and revolutionary agenda. And he continues, nowhere as in Italy had an underground survived so long, cut off from party organisation. Nowhere else did dissident movements so doggedly challenge the authority of official party leaders. And so the Bandiera Rossa had 3,000 militants. And they even the PCI was actually really worried about their impact on PCI members in Rome. So a PCI organiser is quoted complaining that when he suggested that the partisans wear tricolour armbands, you know, the Italian flag, there was a general refusal. And amidst great uproar, they decided they would instead make red ones with the hammer and sickle and to the devil with the tricolour. The Bandiera Rossa in many ways, I think prophetically kind of argued that a nationalist policy of, basically collaborating with the old bourgeois forces and the allies, that would lead to disastrous repercussions after the war. The class composition of Rome and the deliberate fascist policy of deindustrializing the capital mitigated against Bandiera Rossa putting their working class politics into action. So, you know, their base was in outer suburban slums, with high unemployment and very few large factories. So completely the opposite to a city like Turin, an industrial heartland which has been described as Italy's Petrograd. And at times, Bandiera Rossa descended into just basically banditry. So in terms of the allies, I just want to look a bit at the resistance's relationship to the allies. So the partisans made a huge contribution to the Allied war effort. And from the Allies' point of view, they knew that having 150 to 200,000 armed partisans on their side was a huge military asset. So just to try to illustrate this, at the end of the war, there were 32 fascist divisions, 18 of which, this is German fascist divisions, 18 of which were on the front lines fighting the Allies, 14 were behind the lines to deal with the partisans. A US Army document was clear and clinical. Quote, it was inexpensive to supply partisans and evidence suggests they made good use of ammunition. But Allied support to the partisans was actually limited. So their supply drops to partisans focused on non-military goods, and even some of these were useless. And I think there was a conflict between what the Allies wanted from the partisans and what they got. The Allies wanted loyal subjects completely under Allied command who would risk their lives but make no demands. What they got was hundreds of thousands of armed fighters, largely workers, and led by communists, alongside a political mass movement and strikes in the cities. This threatened their interests, and the Allies actually subordinated military considerations to political ones. So key to this was in November 1944, where the Allied General Alexander made a proclamation to cease operations and cut off supplies for months. The partisans were ordered to go home, which is just an absurdity, an impossibility for people operating outside the law. The partisan movement survived, but was weakened. And so I think Britain and the US's alliance with the partisans in Italy was based on geopolitical considerations, not a principled anti-fascism. In December 1944, resistance leaders agreed that upon liberation, they would disarm and hand over military and political power to the Allies. And in return, they would receive some funding from the Allies. But the question arises, how much did the resistance actually need the Allies? When they were short of money, occasionally the resistance would just extort money from bosses. And the other factor is that it wasn't in the interest of either the resistance or the Allies to have a complete break. You know, both kind of needed each other, which suggests that the resistance may have had enough leverage to make less political concessions to the Allies. I want to talk about the role of women a little bit. Women were involved in all aspects of the resistance. So they were involved as workers, such as during the March 1943 strikes. They were anti-fascist activists under Mussolini, as well as during the years of the resistance. And they were armed fighters. So there were female commanders and all female units. Some urban militias were led by women, such as the 7th Gianni Gap group in Emilia-Romagna, which was commanded by Novella Vanda Albertazzi. And 80 out of 200 members of this group were women. Albertazzi said, "It seemed absurd and impossible to stay bent over a table 10 hours a day to gossip with friends while the Germans walked the streets while the fascists arrested young men." And I think the high level of involvement of women shows the deep impact the resistance had on Italian society. Italian society was, like other societies, very sexist. Women were not allowed to serve in bourgeois armies at the time. They didn't have the vote in Italy, but were granted the vote after the resistance struggle. And so I'm not trying to say that the politics of the PCI and of male partisans was perfect, because it wasn't. But the mass struggle opened up a space for women's involvement in politics and for sexist attitudes to be overcome. And the common purpose shared by men and women partisans meant that the partisan activity tended towards unity and equality. So an estimated 35,000 women took part in military action, and 512 women were recognised to have been political commissars. So that's some women partisans in Bologna. Just quickly on the partisan republics. The Marxist historian Tom Behan, who's written some of the most important English language works on the Italian resistance, and whose work I'd really recommend, he said of the Italian resistance, quote, "A society which seemed extremely stable and controlled, destined to continue in the same way forever, suddenly exploded from below with mass activity, such that for a brief period, everything seemed possible." Well, nowhere was this more true than the partisan republics. So these were liberated zones controlled by the partisans in the north, where the creativity of ordinary people was on full display, albeit briefly. So one example was the Ossola Republic, which lasted for about a month in September and October 1944. Factories reopened and made arms for the resistance and helped to sabotage the Nazis. Crime was nowhere to be seen, and the Republic produced Italy's first female minister, the communist Gisella Floriani, who was the Minister for Welfare. Trains into Switzerland even started running again. New stamps were produced and there was a football match which the Partisans lost 5-1. Okay, so moving now to the final liberation of Italy in 1945 and the insurrections. So insurrections took place in all of the cities of the Industrial Triangle, Milan, Turin and Genoa, which finally threw off the shackles of fascism on April 25, 1945. And like I said before, these took place before the Allies arrived. Just to focus on one city, Genoa, in the lead up to the insurrection, there were 30,000 fascist troops in Genoa and surrounding areas. The partisans had 4,000 to 5,000 fighters in the mountains nearby and 3,000 under arms in the city itself, mostly with just handguns. The Allies didn't want a mass insurrection, but the partisans called for one anyway. The Germans wanted to be allowed to withdraw from the city unscathed and threatened to destroy neighbourhoods and factories if they weren't allowed to. The partisans said no. They would only accept unconditional surrender from the Nazis. And so the battle was on. The Genoa CLN called on people to arm themselves, and ordinary people spontaneously joined partisan squads. They armed themselves with weapons seized from fascists. An army of 10,000 Nazis surrendered and the city was saved. Gunther Meinhold, a decorated major general and career officer in the Nazi army, surrendered to an emaciated partisan in civilian clothes named Remo Schiappini. He was president of the regional CLN, an industrial worker and a Communist Party Central Committee member. And in the days after the liberation, Mussolini and his closest associates were executed by partisans. Mussolini had refused to surrender when he had the chance and was captured by partisans. The CLN had passed a death sentence on fascists who had not surrendered. The Allies tried to stop partisans from executing Mussolini, but were too late. That's the surrender document for Genoa. So workers, partisans and ordinary people liberated the North. When the Allies arrived, city after city was functioning, public services running, work restarted. There's an armed working class which has overthrown fascism itself and led by communists. So some bosses were worried about the prospect of social revolution. But the PCI leadership was Stalinist. And while the party insisted on the need for the working class to liberate its own cities through insurrection and not wait for the Allies, but the insurrection, carried out by workers, was to be a self-limiting insurrection aimed at giving the PCI leaders a bargaining chip to ensure their participation in the post-war Italian state. It was not about mobilising the masses to create their own organs of working power. Togliatti himself said, "The insurrection we want does not have the goal of imposing social or political changes in a socialist or communist sense." So I think there's actually no contradiction between the militant tactics used to win liberation from fascism and the conservative nature of the political horizons of the PCI leadership, who wanted to preserve Italian capitalism. So standing down ceremonies were held, partisans were given certificates and handed in their arms, and the Allies took over control of the cities. There was a grand coalition government where each of the anti-fascist parties had representation, and Togliatti from the PCI became justice minister, was one of three PCI ministers. So while the goal of defeating fascism was achieved, the dream of a socialist society many partisans had was not. And partisans were disappointed with post-war Italy. Factory bosses who had collaborated with fascism and profited from the war stayed around. The purging of the state apparatus was very limited, and Togliatti himself shamefully passed an amnesty, which meant many fascist acts of torture, rape and murder went unpunished. The judges acquitting fascists were often judges who had served under fascism. So, for example, Giuseppe Azzariti, who worked closely with Togliatti, had been president of the Tribunal of the Race from 1938 to 1943. And hunger and rationing continued. Many former partisans suffered unemployment. You know, so it's a sad sort of end to the tale. But the only way that many ordinary members of the Communist Party, you know, could sort of go along with the leadership was to basically have the leadership lead them to believe that the party really was for revolution, that parliamentarianism was basically all for show, and the day of revolution will come. So there's an Italian term, doppiezza, duplicity, which is basically, you know, this, that going along with the post-war institutions of Italian capitalism was a kind of Trojan horse with revolution, the real agenda. So obviously while there was some military cooperation with the Allies necessary, this didn't compel PCI leaders to take the political strategy that they did of, you know, rehabilitating the old discredited forces of the Italian state and of demobilising the working class upon liberation. In 1972, the PCI political commander, Pippo Coppo, identifying with the struggles of workers and students in the 60s and 70s, said, "As commissars, our task was to explain to young people why they had to fight, why we had to fight fascism, and what we wanted after its end. It's not as if we wanted the society we got. We wanted another society, the kind of society that workers and students today are fighting for." Workers hid their arms on a huge scale. So in Milan's suburbs, arms were discovered years later in the 1960s after urban sprawl had meant that the outskirts of the city expanded. So some sort of arms that had been stashed under the ground were going to be built on with apartment blocks or whatever. And so I think the burying of arms on a mass sort of scale, on one level, reveals workers' agency in keeping some insurance against a revival of fascism. But also, for Claudio Pavone, the burying of the machine gun was a symbol of the covering up of the future, a road that could have been trod. In terms of assessing the PCI strategy of national liberation first, social and political reform second. The historian Paul Ginsborg has argued that this caused the PCI to dissipate the strength of the resistance and of worker and peasant agitation, that at the very moment when the partisan and workers' movement was at its height, the communists accepted the postponement of all questions of a social and political nature until the end of the war. It's the end of the quote. And in turn, these honourable compromises during the resistance period, like recognising the bourgeois state apparatus of the King and General Badoglio, these compromises conditioned what happened after the liberation, you know, leading to a very shoddy deal, to say the least, for those who had fought fascism. To come back to Pavone, so it was a class war, a civil war, and a war of national liberation all at once. So with this categorisation, you can start to analyse the strategic decisions made by party leaders, by partisans, and by the allies at the time. But it also impacts how the Italian resistance is remembered. So while outside Italy, the contribution of the partisans can just basically be erased, writing them out of history with it being thought that the Allies liberated Europe, inside Italy, the resistance is remembered, but largely with a nationalist mythology. So it's the war of liberation that gets pushed to the forefront, a glorious war of liberation, a patriotic war fought by Italian patriots against the, you know, German invaders. The myth-making of the Communist Party really started during the resistance itself. But I think, you know, remembering the resistance only in this way actually erases some inconvenient truths. Italian society was bitterly divided along class and political lines. And fascism was an anti-working class movement adopted by the Italian ruling class in a period of capitalist crisis in the early 1920s to wipe out working class institutions like parties and trade unions. The big industrialists backed this, the king, the Catholic Church, and so on. Judges, police, senior civil servants were all, they were fascist party members and served fascism. And that became an inconvenient truth for the Communist Party because the vast majority of these people were not purged. But then on the other hand, in terms of workers, there was actually a very high price to be paid for the courage of those fighting the resistance. Thousands were shot for striking, deported to Nazi Germany to die in concentration camps, and the rates of casualties of partisans was very high. I don't want to just leave it on that note, but to end with the words of Tom Behan, the resistance was, quote, a struggle from below, marked by self-activity, generosity, improvisation, and comradeship. A subversive and inspiring example that even the most powerful enemy can be defeated. So we owe it to those partisans who sacrificed so much for that better society to draw both inspiration and lessons from their struggle.